coming up on Boston Public Radio. Boston area banks are hoping you'll choose them if they offer you a toaster or someone to clean your house. Would you? Can our consumer affections be bought when we choose cell phone companies, healthcare, or a bank? Then Globe editor Brian McGorin, latest with casinos and the probation corruption trial. Why are no Beacon Hill pals charged with a crime? Then a Boston teacher, Jennifer DeLeon, joins us. Her book, Wise Latinas, Writers on Higher Education.
Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us. Take a look in the mirror. How wrinkled you are can predict how long you're going to live. And then the Boston Globe's Kevin Cullen on Ireland's fragile peace process is now threatened because Boston College released explosive tapes the participants thought would remain confidential. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7. Whoops, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I was worried I went to the wrong place. I was going to say, oh my God.
It happens to me all the time, Jim.
Okay, now, nearly 8 in 10 Americans feel the nation's big banks are to blame for the 2008 financial meltdown, most people would not switch to a credit union or a community bank. And listen to this, only 1 in 4 Americans would even consider moving their checking account from their mega bank to a smaller one. And this is according, by the way, to a recent study done by Consumer Banking Insight. So how are these smaller banks competing with the big guys? According to the Boston Globe today, freebies. That's right. Even though you might get slammed with fees, some of these banks are banking on freebies, or what they like to call freemiums. I love that word, freemiums. Toasters, Tupperware, 4 hours of house cleaning, an electric blanket, they're all back. Belmont Savings Bank, listen to this one. The ones that have branches, you know, in grocery stores, They have set up, Marjorie, a mini wheel of fortune. A new customer gives it a spin and finds out how much money you can knock off your grocery bill. So to you at 87, that's exactly their point. 877-301-8970. Do freebies work? Do they work on you? Even though we have the resources, particularly look at your computer to be savvy and inform consumers, do you fall for these gimmicks? You know, when you're choosing anything, a cell phone company, healthcare, or a bank, as I say, our number is 877-301-8970. Can your consumer judgment be bought with a toaster? And I would argue, I mean, these banks are not just doing this to spur the moment. Wait, just one second. Let me just say this one thing. If they hadn't done tons of research and been convinced that a toaster would cause them to get a customer who they would not otherwise get, then they wouldn't be doing it to begin with. So they must work.
Okay, it's not just toasters.
Okay, what is it?
Did you read about the rolling cooler with speakers?
I did. What bank is that?
That's also Belmont Savings Bank.
It is? That's great.
I mean, think about it. In the summertime, you get a rolling cooler right over to South Boston to go to the beach. I mean, can't you just see going into the supermarket with a Wheel of Fortune deal and you could get $75 off your groceries. Who wouldn't want to do that?
No, and you say to yourself, well, I could go home and compare the fees, the checking fees, the interest rates, all that sort of thing. Or what I could do is take home a free electric blanket and maybe end up with a bank that's going to treat me more poorly.
Well, see,
I am telling you.
Here's the thing. Lots of people have no idea how much they're paying for their checking account or how much they pay for a bounce check.
And they're intimidated by it.
And it's a big hassle to change your bank. You could go through, especially when you're getting, you know, a direct deposit from work and stuff like that. It's a big deal. But I have for years belonged to a credit union because I used to be a credit union in the basement of the Boston Herald.
Yeah.
And I joined them years ago. And I loved it because there were only 2 tellers that worked there. And so if you were kind of behind and you were out of money, they let you take money out of your Christmas club and stuff like that.
Well, that's an informed decision.
Right.
Proximity, services, all I'm saying. Here's my analysis of this, which they don't get into in this good story by Deirdre Fernandez in the Globe. Banks trying giveaways for new customers. Banks steal page from past with prizes. I think that most people are so overwhelmed by the daunting task of choosing between healthcare providers, as I said, cell phone companies, banks, that what they do is they'll grasp at anything. And if the thing that is sitting right in front of them, I mean this generically, is a toaster, they're going to go for the toaster rather than doing the difficult research and investigation. And in a word I use quite a bit, it's pathetic.
Listen
it is really pathetic.
Listen to this. Eastern Bank offers 4 hours of house cleaning.
I know that.
I mean, that's a pretty good deal.
Marjorie's switching today.
Well, I don't know. Do I want to get the speaker with the rolling cooler with speakers? Or I want to get the 4 hours of house cleaning. It's a tough choice. But the problem is it's going to take you 4 hours, if not 8 hours, to do all the rigmarole you need to do to change banks.
You don't think this is a horrible commentary? The fact that these things were – no, I'm serious about this. The choices – what bank you go to matters a lot, I would argue. What healthcare company you choose matters a lot. All these things I mentioned. And people apparently feel I mean, it's the only reason I assume they do. You know, if all things are equal and you get a free whatever Marjorie just said, then it's fine. But it's not because all things are equal. It's because people don't want to do the hard work and go through the emotional strain of making choices.
East Boston Savings Bank, a charcoal barbecue grill. Or a beach chair.
That's pretty good.
I mean, well, it's clever.
How do you decide between the two,
I guess,
though?
In the wintertime. You know, you get in the wintertime, you get a snowblower.
You do. I don't think so. 877-301-8970. Again, there's a narrow topic here, which is banks trying these giveaways, sort of a blast from the past to get new customers or get people, new customers. And the larger question is, it's symptomatic of our inability to make an informed decision about anything. By the way, do you know when this started? I wasn't Chelsea, our colleague, gave us something. This freebie thing. Did you read when it started?
Jell-O.
100 years ago, Jell-O, the freebie that they did, the early 20th century, they gave away hundreds of free Jell-O recipes, the homeowners, because they didn't know what to do with the new product. And that began this trend of free stuff. And by the way, let me just say, I'm acting as if I am somebody who doesn't fall for this. I fall for it, too. Free stuff is a real lure.
There is nothing like a good Jell-O mold with those little tiny baby marshmallows.
It doesn't get much better.
It's just horrible. And the Jell-O with the skin on the top, you know what I mean? You
have to kind of peel it off. It's been in the refrigerator for a week. 877-301-8970. So is this whole freebie thing at the banks, or freemiums as they're now called, I love that term, is this symptomatic of the fact that our consumer affections can be bought incredibly cheaply, not based upon the quality of the product or the service, but based upon what we get, what free, and obviously these Boston area smaller banks, at least some of them, believe that it can be, or they wouldn't be doing it. Let's start in Boston with Kevin. Kevin, you're on Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi there.
Hi there. I guess my take on it is that the prizes are sort of to overcome an inertia that's involved with changing services like this. Your checking account is so ingrained in your life that it's just so painful to change it. You need something to get off the dime. And the fact of the matter is, I think some of these smaller banks, you say that you'll get hit with these fees. Well, I disagree. If I were a manager in a smaller bank, I'd be saying, why are all these people sticking with these giant banks that are just abusing their customers when all these smaller banks are such a better deal, which I happen to think is true. And so, but it's this inertia involved with making a change.
So you're saying that you are an informed consumer, but an informed consumer who sits on his behind, and what gets you to act on your information is this freebie thing, so that it's not quite as depressing a picture as I'm painting.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And I'm guilty of it as an expert, but you know, maybe a folding chair with a drink holder is enough to say, I'm done.
Exactly.
I'm all these big bank services, and I'm going to take your chair, and for that, I'll put a few minutes into trying to make a change.
Can I tell you how I know that we could buy Kevin's affection? When he said with a cup holder, with a drink holder.
With a cup holder.
When he threw that
Isn't
in.
Isn't that one of the great inventions
Kevin,
of all
great.
Times,
Thanks.
Kevin? You know, think about life before you had a cup holder in your car.
It's unbelievable.
You know, what did you do when you went to the drive-thru Dunkin' Donuts? You know what
Spilled
I mean?
Spilled it right in your you-know-what.
Exactly. You had that nice little. Boy, I tell you, when I broke my cup holder, they told me it was going to cost me like $300 to get a new cup holder. I paid it.
That's even sadder, actually. So let me ask you, Marjorie, to make my point here. You have to pick a new bank because you move.
That's right.
You're about to go home. I mean this sincerely. You're about to go do research between Bank A and Bank B. Mm-hmm. And before you do the research, you get a flyer from both banks. They're left under your door. One says you get the free, like Kevin just said, the beach chair with a cup holder. I mean this sincerely. And one says, come to our bank. We have the best service. And do you go to the computer and check out the differences between the two? Look at ratings from customers. Look at fees. I'm serious. Or do you take the freebie and then go to that bank? You
well, do. I might go to the one that said they had better service because that. Does,
oh, you might.
That
well,
does. That
oh.
does. That does matter to me.
Would you do
it
the research like, or would you just take the representation
about how much it charges for checking and all that kind of stuff,
or whether the service actually is? What bank says the service isn't better?
I don't know. I'm easily seduced. I guess is the bottom line. You know, Michael from Roxbury just emailed this, and remember the big uproar, and there was a big uproar when Bank of America was going to charge customers for using the
debit
ATM.
Card with the debit cards.
Yes,
sure.
And then lots of people did leave over that. And
well, it lasted about a week, didn't it, until they got rid of it?
Well, so many people left Bank of America, they shelved the idea within 2 weeks of the announcement.
2 weeks, okay.
And that was after the Bank of America decided to charge customers for using Bank of America teller instead of the ATM. So there are movements that get people so outraged that they do move. There was a thing about fingerprinting people when they went in to cash their checks. Remember that was
but
going
you know,
on too?
Actually, he didn't. What's the guy's name?
Michael from Roxbury.
He didn't tell the whole story. Do you know why people, when they repealed the fee on the ATMs, do you know why people went back to Bank of America? Free personal fans. You know those little things? My mother used to have one of those. You little press a little button with a battery and you have a fan.
Well, you can buy the ones at CVS, you know, with the water in them.
Oh, man. Does that get any better?
It sprays. Like this, wouldn't it
$6?
Be great? Exactly.
Let me tell you, it's the only reason I shop at CVS.
Sheila.
877-301-8970. We're talking about this because there's a story in the Globe about how freebies are coming back to banks, small banks in particular, to try to lure people away. And it got Marjorie and me thinking about whether or not this was not symptomatic of the fact that we are a failed consumer culture. Who will go for the cheap free? Well, cheap is freebie, is oxymoronic, for the freebie rather than doing the work that an informed consumer should be doing.
Sheila from Norton. Hi, Sheila.
Hey, Sheila.
Hi, guys. I think it's a brilliant idea, but I would not switch over for a freebie flowbie. But I do think that it's a very smart idea for young students or anyone young that may be looking to just get an account started. And figures, I'm like setting up an apartment, I'll get a free microwave or something.
Yeah.
And if I were marketing for a bank to get the younger crowd, I would say give away free concert tickets or something. And I don't think there'd be one young person that, if it was a good concert, that wouldn't just switch over or start up in that bank right away.
You're a genius marketer.
Brilliant.
Hey,
yeah,
before you go away, you cannot throw out the term flowbie for the uninitiated. I happen to own one and not explain what a flowbie is. I'll give half the answer. It's as seen on TV.
Yeah.
What is a flowbie, Sheila?
Well, not to disparage you, Jim, saying that you look like you own one, but it's when you have hair that you blow up into the air and then cut it with yourself, with your own scissors.
But how do you blow it up into the air, please?
With your Flowbee.
No,
of
you
course.
Attach the Flowbee to a canister vacuum
cleaner.
And then you put the tip of the Flowbee on your hair. That makes your hair stand up, and then you cut it with a Flowbee. Sheila, thank you for the
suction,
call.
The suction haircut. Alan just emailed and said, think about credit cards. People will give away their firstborn for an airline mile. Myself included, says Alan.
No,
and
it's
that's
totally
a big
true.
One. I mean, how many people do you know that buy everything with their credit card because they can get their mileage up?
Did you say?
But
did
then
we
go
do
on
this
trips,
story, or we just
go on these trips for free?
Did you read? There was a story that we either we did on the air, and my apologies for not remembering, or just one that we discussed with Chelsea about a couple of people who had totally gamed the system with the free miles thing, which is this is all they did full time. Was get free miles, you know, buy things on credit cards, get the free miles,
yeah.
Then return them. Some student or something got a million free miles, traveled all over the world. I mean, the problem is the free thing that we are a culture. I've told this story before in our former commercial radio life, and this is a totally true story.
Mm-hmm.
There were people, not us, there were people, there were five radio stations at some of the other radio stations making either close to or actually seven figures. When an email went out to everybody in the building while we're on the air saying there was free food at the end of the hallway where all five radio stations were, literally every one of us went to commercial break, and it was like roller derby going down. Is that a fair description of what it was like?
Stampede.
Why? Because it was a free slice of ham at the end of... It is unbelievable. 877-301-8970. But there was no harm there. The harm here is you may make a choice, whether it's a bank, again, a healthcare company, whatever it is, based upon this superficial little thing. Even if, I mean, I thought Sheila's point was great. If you have a bank in a place where there are a lot of students,
yeah.
An incoming freshman or incoming graduate students, if you offered concert tickets, it'd be great. But, you know, even though that's appealing, What does that say about the underlying service? It says nothing, except they know how to market it. And I guess I'm making the case you should do more.
877-301-8970 is the phone number. What do you think about these freebies to get you to change your cell phone service, to change your bank, et cetera? Let's go to Andre from Swampscott.
Hi, Andre. How are you?
Hi, I'm well, Jim and Marjorie, but I do want to say there's one exception to that.
What's that?
When you guys are having your fundraiser or for contributions to public radio stations.
Pledge week,
I do contribute.
Oh,
I
good.
Do contribute
good.
To try to get the free iPad or try to get the free trip to Italy or France. But that's the exception because it is worth it because, you know, you do get the wonderful stories that you guys cover and it's worth it.
Andre, you're a sweetheart.
You're a sweetheart, and I'm going to tell you a little story. Yesterday, they had a little event in the lobby, that was a little breakfast kind of thing, and one of our colleagues came upstairs with a little free bag that says WGBH, fresh and local, nice little orange
tote
bag.
Tote bag, yeah, it was nice.
And 2 seconds later...
Where were we? In the lobby.
Racing down the hall from one end of the building of the other to get this little free bag.
Andre, I'm glad you pointed this out. I had forgotten that there is a certain level of reward with a certain level of pledge to GBH.
Yeah,
but we're glad you like the product.
Cost?
Hey, Andre, thank you.
For 99 cents or something like that?
I don't know.
You
have to talk to the bosses.
We were like bats out of hell, Jim.
877-301-897. You know, I know that you get flummoxed by this. I don't mean this critically. I think you admit it yourself.
Flummoxed by what?
The beauty of there is virtually nothing where there is not comparative concern. You don't have to do 10 years ago, if you went online to compare banks, for example.
Right.
Or cell phone. You basically do the work yourself. All the work is done. The Yelps, and I don't just mean Yelp, the generic Yelps, there is comparative analysis of everything. And the fact that that takes a back seat, I'm sorry to keep repeating myself, but it drives me crazy, to a toaster is just...
But aren't you suspicious of Yelp? I am.
No, I will.
I always think
you don't just stop
that they're writing nasty things about their competitors and all
maybe.
That kind of stuff.
Well, you don't stop. I mean, I'm not suggesting you stop there. All I'm saying is everything is literally at your fingertips to be an informed comparative consumer is what I guess I'm saying.
Okay, Robert from Woodstock, are you an informed comparative consumer or are you
Hi, Robert.
Going in to get the free barbecue grill?
Well, I'm an informed comparative consumer, and what I'd like to point out is the major banks, one that you just mentioned, just keep adding charges that aren't supposed to be there. You have to scour your statement every month to find out what they put in there. And then lately, they just started to charge me for checks, and that was enough to go to a local bank. So it wasn't the fact that I wanted the freebie. The major banks, it was really adding up, and I keep a significant amount in my checking account. I got it years ago when my daughter went to college. The advantage was I could transfer money from my checking to her checking in a matter of minutes, and it would show up.
Well, then you theoretically made that decision based upon the quality and breadth of the service. But to end the story, did you get a freebie when you made a switch?
Yeah, I did. Believe it or not, I think it was a flashlight.
Flashlight.
That is great.
You know,
Robert,
you've
that
never
was
had
great.
A,
Thank
it's
you.
Like when you go to one
a
of
flashlight.
These events, you know. I mean, I went to that Simmons College event for women a few weeks ago when Hillary Clinton came to speak, and they gave you this little bag of swag. And, you know, you got a couple little flashlights, a couple little nail files, you know, stuff that would cost you like $7. It was so exciting to open that up. I mean, what is that about?
By the way, everybody, just so that people don't feel bad, because I think I'm beating this with too big a stick here. You followed like the awards shows that the people who are nominated for Academy Awards
get like $30,000-$40,000
worth of
swag.
And by the way, they don't need it either. $30,000-$40,000 of swag to them is like getting a free tote bag like we got yesterday in the lobby of WGBH. But the point is, everybody likes something for nothing. It is just amazing.
There. Women that have these professional careers and they're you know, very successful open up these little bags like we've got gold nuggets inside them. It was unbelievable. 877-301-8970. All these banks to try to lure consumers, not all these banks, but many banks to try to lure consumers in
are around
giving
Boston,
away,
yeah.
Giving away things like Tupperware, like toasters, like electric blankets. Wrong time you're going to be giving away electric blankets, if you ask me. 4 hours of house cleaning. Stuff like that. They're giving away, my favorite thing of all, is the guy from, which is the bank that's giving away the roller the rolling cooler with speakers. Oh, the
That's Belmont Savings Bank.
So if you go over to Belmont Savings, you can get a rolling cooler with speakers to take to the beach. Would this be enough to turn you in that direction?
Before you go back to the calls, Belmont Savings Bank, as you mentioned before, is also the one that has the Wheel of Fortune
thing.
That's right. Where new customers spin a wheel at the bank's grocery store branches to get up to $150 off their shopping bill. No one would like $150 off their shopping bill more than I.
Yep.
Would you have the courage to walk over to a wheel and spin it at the bank you've joined at the supermarket?
Absolutely.
In front of other people? You would do this.
Of course.
You would flip, you would cause the wheel, like Wheel of Fortune, you would cause the wheel to go around to see your prize?
Why not? Well, I'm not as famous as you, Jim.
That wasn't my point, Marjorie. It was not. It had nothing to do with fame or lack of
there's
fame.
There's Jim Browdy. Let's go over and get his autograph. Katie from...
he just got $7 of free groceries in the beauty lane.
Katie from is it Greenville, Rhode Island, or someplace in Rhode Island?
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Katie.
It's
Green. Hi. Where is Green, Rhode Island? I never heard of it.
It is in Coventry. It's a village.
Oh, okay. Great. Part of Coventry, Rhode Island. Okay.
Thanks for the call, Katie. What's up?
So are you susceptible to these pitches, Katie, or not?
I am. I am totally guilty of it. But I used to work at a small local bank. We only had 6 branches. And around the time that I was a teller, around the time that Bank of America instated their teller fees, mm-hmm. we had people come in very aggravated from the Bank of America branch around the corner. And our freebies got them in the door, but the good service that was provided kept them there. And I think freebies are a really important tool for local banks to stay afloat and to keep local people employed. Of course, service matters and the rates matter. For me, I'm happy to pay a little bit higher rate if it goes to a local business.
I am so where you are on shopping and banking and whatever local. But, you know, Katie, you're a variation on our first call, Kevin, who said that he does do comparative shopping. He does decide what's the best bank, that sort of thing. But what gets him, what did he say, the incentive to actually get off his duff and go do something,
right,
like what you're describing was the freebie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it works, as long as it's paired with some, as you say, the service being what keeps him, then I feel a little bit better about the whole thing. Katie, thank you for the call.
Shoshana in the car. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, Shoshana.
Are you there?
Oh, you're there.
Hi.
So my point was that I'm a stay-at-home mom. We're not wealthy by any means, but we have good credit score. So we have Bank of America, and we get everything for free, plus points to do everything with them. And they have a lot of drive-thrus, and I have young children. But the thing that's most disconcerting are the people that can't even get a checking account because they don't have a good credit score and have to go to the check cashing services.
Oh.
And I don't even know. I can't imagine what those fees are. Exorbitant. So I don't know when it became legal to deny someone a checking account because of a certain credit score, but... it seems to be a very bad thing.
Well, you know, also, it isn't my area of expertise, but what is the downside if you're not going to cash a check? We know next time the attorney general's in here, we'll ask her. If you're not, they're not going to cash a check that exceeds the amount of money you have, what's the relevance of your credit score if you're a bank making a decision about a new customer, Shoshana? Why does it matter?
I have no idea. And they have so much recourse if you do bounce a check that, you know, it seems that they don't need that extra level of protection.
Well, I promise you, next
you know,
time Martha Coakley's in here, we'll ask her the question.
That's a great
Thank
point,
because
it is so unfair. I mean, obviously, you're even more in hock than you were beforehand if you got to pay a massive, you know, fee.
Well, also, if you get an account, even though it wasn't our topic of the day since Shoshana brought it up, if you can only maintain a relatively small balance, you're paying fees through the you-know-what. If you can maintain a larger balance and you arguably can afford to pay the fee, that's when you don't have to pay. Let's take one more.
Harry from Stoughton. Hi, Harry.
Hey, Harry.
Hi, folks. Jim's comment about informed consumer decisions got me thinking. By the way, I'm a sucker for freebies like every American.
Me too, Harry.
Free pens and free hats particularly. I can be had free.
Oh, you're easy. Free pens. You are easy.
Yeah, I'd like to broaden the topic a little bit. Do you remember the day, speaking of informed consumer decisions, when the major local TV stations and the major radio stations had Consumer Reporters as mainstays on their staff.
Yes, I do.
I never see them anymore.
Well, let me just say, we have one of the great Consumer Reporters and one of the funniest and smartest people on the planet, Leslie Gatiss on NECN.
Does a great job on NECN.
Does a thing called Does It Work, which is both funny but great. But you're right. There are fewer Consumer Reporters.
Susan Warnock used to do it at WCVB.
Do you remember Eleanor Green?
No.
That far back on radio many years ago. I guess I'm giving away my age. Anyway, do you think it's because they don't want to offend advertisers? Or what is it that stops them from doing more consumer reporting?
I think it's just money, Harry. I think that the news stations are getting less and less. They have less and less money, and newspapers obviously have less and less money too. So,
hey, Harry, if you leave your address, we'll send you a pen. Thank you, Harry. Thanks for listening, Harry.
Okay, up next, we're going to be joined by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGroy, for his read on the local headlines. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Great music of all stripes is what's on tap for this year's WGBH Boston Globe Summer Arts Weekend. Saturday, July 26th kicks off with Fun for the Kids and culminates with Los Lobos. And Sunday, the 27th, it's the Boston Landmarks Orchestra, followed by Cuban trumpeter Arturo Sandoval. Great music all weekend long in Boston's Copley Square, July 26th and 27th. See the entire lineup at bostonsummerarts.com, presented by Citizens Bank.
Support for WGBH comes from you and North Shore Music Theater. Disney's The Little Mermaid is coming to life at Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater. The Under the Sea musical is at North Shore Music Theater from July 8th to 27th. NSMT.org. And Orchard Cove, reminding you of their 20th anniversary celebration. You can find out what Orchard Cove has in store at OrchardCoveLive.org. That's OrchardCoveLive.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And joining us on the phone, as he does every single Wednesday, is the editor of the Boston Globe. That would be Brian McGroy. Hello there, Brian.
Hello, Jim Browdy. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks, Brian.
Hey, Brian McGroy. Thanks for being with us.
Well, I have to ask, you guys vacation the same weeks.
Yeah, we do.
That's right.
Do you vacation together?
No.
We do. We're going to.
We stay in touch.
You do like the special WGBH cruise or something like that with Jim and Marjorie?
Who told you that? The name section of the paper?
I can picture Jim on the side of a cruise ship trying to make no eye contact with any of the passengers who have paid huge money to be with him.
That's right. He'd have to hide below decks.
I will neither deny nor confirm.
Actually, we're going to go to sandals. I think we're going to sandals in Antigua. Is that how you say it? Antigua. I always forget how to pronounce that. You know, Brian McGroy, I thought this was a brilliant idea. I think the Herald should start doing this immediately because I've been Grouponing my life for several years now. You know, get the detailing on the for your cars. That's one of the best deals ever. You guys at the Boston Globe are Grouponing. Jim told me he just got one.
Look, we're doing anything we can to make a buck over here within ethical limits. And, there was a Groupon offer. I don't know the details. Do you know the details?
Unfortunately, I'm a subscriber already, so I didn't do it.
I
thought
too.
It was great. I loved it. I was shocked at first, to be candid. But then I said to myself, why am I shocked? Just like you and Marjorie talk about all the time, about how to financially keep the newspaper industry alive and well. What better idea than to bring people in? And by the way, it's the same sort of discount you guys offer to subscribers through normal means. I don't think it's anything extraordinary. It's just using a different vehicle, Groupon, which I think is brilliant, actually.
Yeah, let's never use the word, though. Unfortunately, I'm a subscriber. let's get past that immediately.
But I'm going to tell you something to make you feel good. I live in a two-family, and the people below me are always young. They're always like in their 30s or 35s. And sometimes they're all, you know, wired up, and they're not getting any newspapers, period. But when I have left my papers out there, it is amazing how often the kid who's like 35 will pick it up because you just don't get. I mean, I know I'm older, but you don't get everything online that you do in the broadsheet and the hand paper. So I think when you get them, you could get some more people. I think it's a great idea.
I do too.
Well, it's interesting when you read the Globe or any paper, the Herald, Journal, Times, online. It's an entirely different kind of presentation, and you don't, as you said, Marjorie, you miss stuff. You don't tend to capture everything that was in that day's paper. It's a little bit more of a mishmash. It's one reason why our replica edition, our e-reader, is so popular. It's a stagnant presentation, but it's that day's paper presented online or on an iPad, and you literally just kind of slide your finger across the screen and it rotates to a new page. But I don't know, there's some people that think that print may actually make a comeback someday among a younger audience because of this. I'm not necessarily banking on it, but it wouldn't entirely shock me either.
Well, you know, the thing is about the e-readers is that you know you have the judgment of the editors that said, this is the most important thing. We're putting this on the front page today. And in a lot of the ways, when you read papers online, you don't get that. It's just the list of stories. And so I don't know enough to know what's important. So I find it, I like it when I have everything arranged for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, and it's actually a really interesting point because when I came into this job, I realized that we put an extraordinary amount of thought into how the front page and the rest of the paper was arranged in terms of importance, and I have this theory about points of entry in the paper, about the most important news doesn't necessarily have to be at the top of the front page. We can have different points of entry for people, and they might find a really good feature story at the top of the front page that will get them into the rest of the paper and get them reading it in a more enjoyable way. But we would put all this thought into the print edition of the paper, and yet our online, our digital presentation would be more moment by moment.
Yeah.
We've altered that some. We have an extraordinarily good editor of BostonGlobe.com, a young guy by the name of Jason Tuohy, who's just very, very good at what he does. We brought in a digital guru, David Skok, who is overseeing our digital journalism operations here. And increasingly, over the past year or two, we have put more thought into how we present our stories on Globe.com as well, so that people do get a sense of what editors think is important.
You know, speaking of stories, one of the things you've done extraordinarily well, amongst others, is you've covered, I think it's Milton Valencia, and if I'm wrong, I know you correct me, this is probation corruption trial. We talked about it almost every week because, again, for the 4,000th time, there are no cameras in the federal courtrooms, so we don't really get to see this trial. So the impact of this. Now, this is one of these questions where you get to say, I'm not a columnist anymore, but I can't control myself. When you read the story the other day about the prosecutors in their arguments saying that there was an actual, quote, quid pro quo between the Jack O'Brien, John O'Brien, the probation commissioner, who's the defendant, and a guy who I've said many times I really like and have great respect for, the current Speaker of the House, Bob DeLeo, a quid pro quo that essentially they'd hire people that were recommended by DeLeo so that he could allegedly get votes of state reps who recommended those people so he could become speaker, in return for which they'd do good things for the probation department. Did you not say to yourself, well, wait a second, if there's a quid pro quo, why is Jack O'Brien on trial and Bob DeLeo isn't?
You know, Jim, this is exactly one of those situations you're always putting me in.
But
of course I did. Everybody did. And we're all very, very curious why the line was drawn where it is or where it was, and why was O'Brien indicted, why were other public officials, elected officials, not? And there may well be reasonable answers for this. We haven't discerned them yet. We are looking at it. We are exploring it. You know, and I think I can also agree with you. Bob DeLeo is, Speaker DeLeo is a, you know, from what we gather, a well-meaning public servant, but in this case, he's been really, really obviously quiet on these issues. We tried to track him down yesterday all day. He was unavailable to us. His staff would not talk to us. His allies in the House were extremely quiet. So we're going to follow this up, and we're going to take a really close look at why the lines were drawn where they were.
Is Carmen Ortiz, I mean, before you, beyond what DeLeo and other reps or people are saying, or the Senate president, who obviously there's been a lot of testimony about too, has Carmen Ortiz ever, she's the U.S. attorney, for those who don't know, has she ever explained why not one legislator is a defendant in this case?
I mean, in some ways, no. Not that I know. And it goes beyond this. The case where Diane Wilkerson was indicted and convicted for taking the bribes and the city councilor at the same time in Boston.
Chuck Turner.
Why was there not a further investigation of the licensing board at the time? Why was the line drawn where it was at that point in time? There is a tendency in these cases for a lot of open-ended questions about why the pursuit of justice stopped where it did. And again, there may be good reasons for these decisions, but we don't necessarily get them, and they're not something that we're not pursuing. In fact, we are.
We're talking to Brian McGroy, who's editor of the Boston Globe. You know, I have been obsessed with this case because and your original stories about, you know, these totally unqualified people being promoted and hired and into very, very important jobs. All I hope is that the prosecutors, if this doesn't come out in testimony, that when they make their summation argument, they explain that to the jury. Because if I was sitting on that jury, I'd be saying the exact same thing. I've heard about Teresa Murray, the president of the Senate. I've heard about Bob DeLeo, the president of the House. They're not here. And
Mark
we
Montigny
have
hiring, having his girlfriend hire as 21.
Don't forget, she did a very good job.
She did a very good job. But she was unqualified when she was hired. So,
and then you have Judge Mulligan, who's been on the stand last couple of days and being pummeled. So you are left to wonder, then why are we convicting only Jack O'Brien? You know what I mean?
It's you said it very well, Marjorie. And the whole thing, in fact, isn't this like picking up a great big rock on a hot summer day and seeing the creepy crawlies underneath it? It's
yeah.
We are really seeing how government works up there when we're seeing a judge like Mulligan, hammered on the stand and have to testify to some of the things he did about him and about others. It's it's quite extraordinary what's going on up there.
And, you know, he's such a distinguished guy. If you see him, I think he's about 6'4", 6'5". He's very, very tall. His brother was in there last week. And I remember sentenced a rapist to like 175 years in jail about 15 years ago. I thought it was great. And this is not a proud moment in the career of Robert Mulligan
at
all.
Not.
You know, Brian, earlier this morning, it's going to play later in the show, we interviewed Kevin Cullen, who's one of your columnists who just came back from Belfast to see what the fallout of the releasing of the documents and the recordings for this Belfast project, which obviously was one where people involved in the so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland spoke freely based upon what they thought were commitments from Boston College to keep this material under lock and key until the participants had died. They didn't do it because some of the cops in Northern Ireland wanted it. They asked the U.S. Attorney's Office, or at least the Attorney General, for it, and the Attorney General said yes. Carmen Ortiz, yet again, issued subpoenas, and B.C. complied. And now some people are worried not only about the future of the peace there, but about the lives of some of the participants. We asked Kevin this question, and I'm interested, particularly since you do what you do for a living and you're a local kid, is do you think Boston College fought hard enough? I mean, Kevin said to us, and again, this will play a little bit later, this is the dream of a reporter, standing up on principle, saying, I'm not giving up a source. If you got to go to jail, you got to go to jail.
Well, not all reporters are dreaming about going to jail.
Well, okay, fine. So you know what I mean. You know what I mean. They'll listen to Kevin in a little while. What was your reaction to Kevin? Well, again, reaction to the release of the documents yet again, when you read Kevin's story, Brian McGroy.
Well, first of all, I thought his story on the front page of the Sunday paper was extraordinary.
Fabulous.
Nobody knows Ireland like Kevin Cullen does. Nobody knows the Troubles like Kevin Cullen does. He has lived through it. He has been there during the negotiations, during the Mitchell Accord. He was there during the hardest times, and he was there during the peace process, and he knows intimately the players involved. And what he did was he went over to Ireland, and he showed, in a way that nobody else in this country or that country has shown, the ramifications of BC's decision to release this material. And it was frightening. When you think of what might happen over there now, what might happen to the peace process, and what might happen to the fragile peace, and what might happen to the individual players involved. So, I mean, look, you're asking me to weigh in on whether BC caved too soon or whether it should have relinquished the documents at all. I mean, I'm not. going to get into that for obvious reasons, but what we did was show the impact of BC's decision, and I think that was pretty plain for all to see.
You know, let me just say one thing about Kevin Cullen, since he said nobody knows it better than he does. I told Mark, I've been to Ireland once in my life about 7 or 8 years ago. I stayed in three different places. This is a true story. I told Marjorie at the time. Every single place I stayed, when I was signing the book and said I was from Boston, you know what the first question somebody asked me was? Do you know Kevin Cullen? It's totally, I haven't even told Kevin that story. That is a totally true story. And, you know, Brian, another thing with which I am obsessed, I know you're going to say I have a lot of obsessions. When I read the story, the first story, I think we discussed with you already, the thing out of Everett on the casino front, essentially that there was a failure to disclose relationships that were had by the mayor there, and that there were two felons who may or may not still be involved in the ownership of the land. And then we find out after Dan Rizzo, the mayor of Revere, we learned this in the Globe, has been trashing those miscreants over there in Everett. Turns out he had taken financial contributions from both of these guys. But that's not
right.
It seems to me as an outside observer that a guy who I was totally convinced was going to fight this whole thing and ultimately come out for repeal, Marty Walsh, by cutting a deal with the casino in Revere, it seems to me that it's not the gaming commission anymore, or the gambling commission, that's going to pick between Revere and Everett. Marty Walsh already made the decision. It is going to be Revere because Boston is okay with Revere. Isn't that a fair commentary?
I don't know if that's you're a little strong with that, Jim, that he's in a position to pick which one. I think what Marty Walsh realized is that a suit was going to be incredibly time-consuming, incredibly cost-prohibitive, and that there was a very good chance that he might not win that suit. He had to do, I think, what he felt he had to do, and that was he's negotiating with both sides, with Everett and with Revere, with Mohegan Sun and with Wynn. One side was coming to the table and saying, we really want to play a constructive role here. The other side was saying, we'll go to arbitration and, forgive the pun, roll the dice. Wynn has won in arbitration, a couple of other communities. They've done very, very well in arbitration. And Walsh realizes that he does have some authority here and that it should matter before the Gaming Commission the city of Boston thinks about the two proposals. The question is, and I think this is where you're a little too strong on it, we are a neighboring community in Boston. We're not a host community. So ultimately, can a neighboring community, if that's the term, is a neighboring community? Surrounding community. Can a surrounding community actually sway a vote when technically neither casino is located in that city? I don't know, but I'd be shocked if it didn't have some impact.
Yeah, that was my interpretation of it, that this sort of, Marty Walsh is on board with Mohegan Sun, and so if the Gaming Commission makes their vote, which one to go to, that's going to, I would think, make them much more inclined to go with Mohegan Sun, the one that
But again, Marjorie, the question is, if you're the host community and you're saying we got a really bad deal here, then that is going to matter to the Gaming Commission. If you're a surrounding community, I don't know if it matters enough. I mean, look, Walsh is taking no small amount of flack over in East Boston for cutting this deal. The reality is he knew what authority he had. He knew what power he didn't have. He knew what was really risky, which was going to court. And, I think you got to give the guy some credit, a lot of credit, for cutting the best deal he could here.
You know, while you were mocking me totally inappropriately, but since you're a guest on the show, I took it about my alleged cruise, which I did not take and will never take. Brian, since I assume you weren't listening the other day, do you know I was on vacation last Wednesday when we would have been talking to you? Do you have any idea what I spent Wednesday morning doing? You probably go to some island when you go on vacation. You know where I spent Wednesday morning of my vacation day, Brian McGrory, please?
I absolutely cannot wait to hear this.
Because I'm a responsible journalist of sorts, I was at the Gaming Commission hearing at Bunker Hill Community College on the issue about whether or not they'd put off any decision until after the election. What do you think of that?
I have never met someone so fun-loving in my life who would spend their vacation in Charlestown at a gaming commission hearing.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
You, Jesus, Jim, I hope you put a lot of suntan oil on so you could really glow after that.
Well, I have a suspicion that he goes to these things hoping that people will come up and praise his television show.
Maybe, or praise his radio show. Maybe not.
Like he went to the convention.
Marjorie, I told you the story, right, about being in a restaurant with Jim?
Tell me again.
Did I tell you the story?
I don't know. Tell me again. I can never hear enough Jim stories.
I'd like to hear this too. Go ahead.
So Jim and I, we do this, we skip a night here and there, but we have dinner together most nights.
I did not know.
We're at a restaurant in Newton.
This is only a few weeks ago, by the way.
And we're at a restaurant called Cook, and it's a great little restaurant.
It was.
You know, Jim doesn't actually like to be out in public because people are there, and he's a germaphobe. But a guy comes up to the table, and I am sure he's there to tell me how much he misses my column. And he comes up to the table, and he is fawning all over Jim.
He was.
There you go.
God.
You're on TV. I can't believe this. Can I just say hello? Can my family wave at you from across the restaurant? And Jim is eating it up with more joy than he had his entree. I mean, he was just lapping every moment of it up.
What's your point exactly, Brian?
There is no point. There is no point. I just had to get that out because it's been bothering me for 3 weeks.
Well, I want to just add a little something to that. When Jim did go to the Democratic Convention, I arrived there and I was running around and I noticed that Jim had positioned himself about 25 feet from the stage by the entrance. So everybody that came into the convention, Brian, would have to walk right by him. And he was collecting the hosannas as they walked by.
I was contemplating doing a few interviews. It just never came about. Now, Brian, speaking of me, let's talk about you for a couple of seconds. This is the third week in a row. Well, actually, let me play something for you, which I think will bring back some memories. You made a commitment to us, which you last week, or 2 weeks ago, dishonored, and I'm assuming today you will live up to your commitment. Here's Brian McGorry. Last time we were together, this was exactly 2 weeks ago. Please listen.
I guarantee you.
Next week.
I want you to hear me.
Next week.
Next week, you are going to have not just an answer, but you're going to have an answer you're very pleased with.
Okay, well, it wasn't next week because we were off. I was at the Gaming Commission hearing on my vacation, and Marjorie was wherever. What we were talking about, of course, I think Brian is probably panicking as we speak. We are talking about the relatively new, I think there have been about 5 weeks of it, the Capital section, which is the new great political section every Friday in the Boston Globe, and the debate that's going on throughout this city and region as to why it is C-A-P-I-T-A-L rather than O-L. And you apparently did not know the answer when we first asked, but we're going to get it. So you guaranteed us we'd have an answer, and it would please us. What's the answer, please?
So I have the answer.
Okay.
I have the answer, and what I need to do is confirm that the answer I have is actually the right answer. And it's an answer that is, it is both going to please and shock you.
Wow.
I just need to get one bit of further confirmation, and I hope we can address this at the start of the show next week.
Okay, before you leave, that's fine.
He's a very careful reporter.
You're still the editor of the Globe, correct?
Last I checked.
So who would you be getting? Would you have to call John Henry on the phone to make sure this is seriously? Who do you have to run this by?
You know, Jim, some of the things, some of the processes that go on here, I'm not at liberty to share.
Okay,
with you.
Fine.
So
next week, it's what were you to say the odds of getting to the bottom of this are?
Oh, they're like they have been the last couple of weeks. They're 100%.
100%.
You need to take my word on
it. He's on it. He's all over it.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
We'll be waiting.
Brian McGorry, thank you very
much,
Brian, for joining us as always.
Thank you, guys.
See you.
Brian McGorry is editor of the Boston Globe, and he joins us every Wednesday. Up next, MGH is now asking patients, even if they come to the emergency room, how much they're drinking and whether they've taken any illegal drugs. There's also new technology that allows people to figure out from how many wrinkles you have, how long you might live. We're going to talk about that with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Bring a little art into your life and support your community through public broadcasting. The WGBH Fine Art Auction is on. Bid on works donated from New England's top artists and the best galleries on Newbury Street. Paintings, jewelry, sculptures, and more. You might just bring home a masterpiece. Every winning bid supports the programs you count on. It's all online at auction.wgbh.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And the Boston Speaker Series, proudly presented by Lesley University. 7 evenings at Symphony Hall, now in its 4th season. More information online at bostonspeakersseries.org. Sponsored by Dedham Savings. And Liberty Mutual Insurance. Liberty Mutual auto insurance policies come standard with accident forgiveness for those who qualify. You can learn more online at libertymutual.com. That's libertymutual.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bradley. She is Marjorie. And facial recognition technology has given a whole new meaning to the phrase lifeline. Turns out that by using this technology to examine your wrinkles, Marjorie, from fine lines to deep creases in your face, and even the mere implication of these age-related changes, for instance, the tender age of 28, you can gauge how long you'll live by looking at how your face ages and at what rate. It's bad enough to have to see what you'll look like in 20 years. What's even worse is the notion of some insurance underwriter getting a hold of your mugshot to find out how long you'll live. Joining us to discuss this and other medical ethical issues is Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the book Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. All right, so before we get to
I'm putting makeup on right now.
Yeah, exactly. Before we get to our wrinkles and all our model faces, I want to start with a local story, Art, if we may. Mass General Hospital here, this is in a Globe piece. I'm reading it almost verbatim from the lead. They're going to take the step of questioning all patients about their use of alcohol and illegal drugs starting this fall, whether they're coming in for a surgery or if they're just in the emergency room for something like the flu or a strep throat test, et cetera. So is this a good idea?
I think it is a good idea. I think that conversations about prescription drug abuse at a time when we've got a epidemic, it's a bigger problem than heroin and cocaine. The misuse of prescription drugs is that bad. And alcohol-related diseases, injuries, accidents, huge. I might throw in, by the way, a little chit-chat about is there a gun in the house, because I think gun safety should be part of this. I think it's good for medicine to sort of pivot and start to be interested in prevention. Now, I know you go in for your bunions to be removed and you didn't expect a lecture, you know, on drinking. But nonetheless, I think that's what healthcare stands for. Got to be aggressive in terms of trying to reduce risks and harms, costs. That's part of this. I'll tell you what the limit is, Marjorie. It's time. You know, you start thinking of the list. I saw an article today that the people who go to amusement parks are at a much higher risk of injury. Roller coasters, all that sort of stuff. They weren't talking about cotton candy. They were talking about the ride.
Yep.
So should that be part of the speech, too? Hey, by the way, don't drink and don't go to amusement parks and make sure you're firmly belted in if you do go and you're on the, you know what I mean? It kind of goes almost to infinity, the number of things that we do that are risky. So you got to pick out the key ones, and alcohol and prescription drugs aren't bad. But there is a slippery slope danger.
But you know what I wonder about this, Art? If you were an upstanding member of the community, say you were, you know, a district attorney or you were someone with a job.
A bioethicist.
A bioethicist, exactly. And you were doing something illegal like marijuana, which is still illegal in most places anyway on the weekends, or you were coming home and putting down five cocktails at night, I don't think you're going to tell anybody that.
Well, that's true. And you kind of have to approach it. It's better when it's a trusted doctor, someone who's your primary care provider, if you're lucky enough to have one that knows you, that can sort of get into, hey, by the way, you're practicing safe sex. There are a lot of these things that are pretty touchy for people.
Right.
But I think you can approach the issue on prescription drugs. You can ask. You can sort of say, look, maybe you're not telling me the truth, but if you are not, here's the deal. Lock them up. Don't let the kids get them. Don't mix them. Don't trade them. You know, you give the same speech, so to speak, whether they're truthful or not. Yeah, I think you're right. You're going to get a lot of, how should we put it politely, dissembling.
Yes.
I think the speech that comes back, it's pretty standard anyway.
You know, are you anticipated a question I was going to ask? My reading of this, I haven't read this MGH story in a couple of days, so Marjorie, maybe you'll correct me. My understanding is the who is going to be doing this is a nurse or somebody at an intake setting. And I agree completely with what you said. If a person you trust with whom you have a relationship, like your doctor, and I don't mean to disparage nurses, I love nurses, but it's more likely you're going to see the same doctor, ask you a question about a gun in your house or whether you're, you know, there's an opiate epidemic in New England, mm-hmm. Massachusetts, Vermont, whatever, ask you about that, you're more likely to tell the truth. And equally importantly, you're not as likely to be turned off to answering any question because you feel offended that this person you don't even know is intruding into issues that are not relevant in your estimation to why you're there to begin with. Isn't the who asked the question the critical issue here?
It is, although I'll tell you, what I really think about this is we're not sure what the heck is going on in terms of trying to change behavior. And I might add, we stink at it. You know, there are plenty of people giving speeches about weight and exercise and don't be sedentary, and I'm not sure anybody is doing anything much different. So if we need to assess the intervention. Would a nurse talking to a stranger in the intake at a hospital, is that going to have any impact on you? Think about informed consent there. How many have either of you ever read any form that was presented to you? There, you know, it's not the best informed consent setting, so to speak. Maybe it's better to put the literature in the waiting room. Seems to me people have plenty of time there, and you can put all kinds of messages out about, you know, get your vaccines and lock up your ammo and don't drink a lot, and that may be effective. So I'm all for trying this, but I think you got to assess it because I don't think we really know what works.
You know, one last thing that's related to this. NPR has been doing a series on stress, and they told one of the pieces, they talked about how virtually half of the adult population in the United States says they've had a major stressful event in the past year. Is that something that when there's an intake at a hospital or a doctor's office, as per this MGH discussion, they do ask about or should? Obviously, I think they should be asking about. Do they?
They don't. And mental health sort of gets the backseat. So the depression, the anxiety, are you sleeping well, all of that sort of line of questioning. We don't do that much. I'm not sure if it isn't just a bias against mental health type things. By the way, Jim, that opens up a different issue. You know, a lot of these, a lot of companies are starting to say, I'm going to penalize you if you do unhealthy things, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to make you pay more if you're overweight or smoke for your health care coverage. But I don't hear people saying, yeah, the workplace is pretty stressful. I think, boss, you ought to you know, get that stress out of there. If you're so worried about my health, why don't you make this a less stressful work environment? Try that out, by the way, at NPR or NYU. But so, you know, it's kind of selective on the risk. That's my point. Some things, they're stigmatized. We don't like them. We don't like heavy drinking. That's bad. We don't like fat people. That's bad. Eh, you go skiing. That's okay. It's risky, but it's sort of acceptable kind of thing. And stress. Well, we won't talk about that.
The basic message is the patient should take the fifth when they go. When they're, I mean, that's the horrible part of this. In any case, let's move on.
You know, it is true. We keep yammering on, and we've done it in other conversations about how do we control cost. The way to control cost in American healthcare is to get rid of the sinners. Then in hospitals, you'd have maybe what, three nuns and a Mormon elder left? I mean, there'd be nobody there.
We're talking with Art Kaplan from NYU's Langone Medical Center, our medical ethicist. Art, you wrote a fascinating piece for something I never heard of, secularhumanism.org. I should check this out. But in any case, about when does human life begin, your take on that question and why your answer isn't more well-known. Explain to us.
I think a lot of people duck this issue. People keep saying, oh, when does life begin and the abortion debate. It came up in the Hobby Lobby controversy about contraception. It's around in these personhood laws. Listeners may have heard of different states trying to put it into their state constitution that personhood begins at conception. So I wrote that. I don't know what secularhumanism.org is either. They just picked it up, I suspect. But I wrote it for a magazine and just coming out in Free Inquiry, it's called. And the idea is this. We know some facts that I think are relevant to thinking about abortion. They don't tell us when we should say people begin, but they're not irrelevant to where you draw the line. Very simply, embryos fail more often than not to become people. And the reason is they miswire. They're kind of duds, if you will, at the moment of conception. The genes don't line up properly. An embryo gets made, but it just falls out of the woman's body. She doesn't even notice it. The failure rate is probably 52-55%. So you can say personhood begins at conception, and it is true that every life begins at conception. But what isn't true is that every conception begins a life. In fact, most don't. Now, to me, I don't want to draw the beginning of personhood where most of the things that are described can't become anything. I'm not talking about disabled fetuses or sick people. I'm talking about they don't develop at all. So that's my point. There are facts here that I think bear on a lot of our debate in this very sensitive area of abortion. I wouldn't want to say personhood begins at conception if most of the things created by that, by conception, are not going to do anything.
You know, you just said that's your point in your piece. I would argue a bigger point, at least to me, and a takeaway for me, and Margie and I were discussing it. You identify a villain. You don't use the word. I'll use the word in this piece, or at least a player who's been not terribly likely to engage in this never-ending debate, who could play a major role. Tell people who they are.
It's my peers,
yeah.
Scientists, doctors. We don't hear them talking anymore about what I'm describing as what we know about embryology, about development, about human development. They've run away from this fight. They basically, I think it's just too hot to handle, or they don't want to cross wires with people in Congress who have a strong view about this and maybe also control the NIH, National Institutes of Health, or the NSF budget. So that makes they've just been, in my view, well, cowardly. I think you got to get in there and say, here's at least the facts. 50-55% of embryos fail. Even the ones that implant into the woman's body, a fair number of those don't develop from that point on. So there's a high failure rate associated with human conception. And all this talk about everything that gets created at conception is somehow a person, or I think it's just wrong. I think most embryos don't have the ability or the potential to become a person. And again, draw your lines where you want. I understand it's a value decision and partly a legal decision, but those facts seem to me to bear on this.
You know, by the way, you said draw your line where you want. If I were you, I'd have a buffer zone outside your office after this issue is published.
One last thing on this, Art Kaplan, is you make an argument for when a reasonable point for declaring that the personhood does take place, or that, and it is very much in line with Roe v. Wade. Explain that to people.
So for me, life is a conception. Human life begins, it often fails, and it doesn't produce persons. But personhood, when I think of personhood, I think, well, is the brain there? Is the brain functioning? Is the brain controlling the organs and the systems of the body? Is there something that could, at some point, attain consciousness? When do we say people are dead? Well, we say people are dead when their brains totally can't function anymore, completely cease to exist. So when they start to, if you will, begin to function, that seems to me to be a pretty significant landmark grounded by science to pay attention to in terms of where you might say personhood begins. Guess what? That's about the Roe v. Wade line.
Yep.
That's about 6 months.
We're talking Art Kaplan from NYU. Art, so I opened this segment by mentioning that apparently there is some new technology, and you'll tell us whether it's reliable or not, what stage it's at, where facial recognition would allow people with some level of expertise to determine how long you were going to live. I saw you on CNN a couple of weeks ago, and I called Margie, and I said, the guy's going to be 120, and he's still going to be on our show. So you're looking. How reliable? Is this a pipe dream, or is this real? What are the risks? What are the benefits? What's the deal here?
Well, let me open this up by saying nobody wants to know. This is the funny thing is we all look at this and say, ooh, maybe you can tell how long I'm going to live. But every time you show up with a test that says, oh, you're going to get Alzheimer's, or you're going to be dead of cancer by blah, 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 people shy away and drove.
Wait a second. Wait, Art, you have never filled out one of those online things where you type in all of your personal facts
your
lifestyle and things, and you like 40 questions to find out how long you're going to live. You haven't done that?
I did. I have. And then I look at it and I say,
ass, a lot of BS.
That's exactly.
I don't do anything. I don't do anything differently. I don't care. I don't even tell my wife. I don't tell anybody. I don't care. I've done it in private. It's not that I'm ashamed. It's just like stupid. I don't really care. So, in an ethics sense, most people don't want to go through life knowing their due date. They don't know their expiration date. They don't want to know when they're going to die. They don't like that knowledge hanging over their heads. If you could do something about it, slow aging or modify your faith, then I think people start to get interested. But if I said to you, we're all going to be dead at the end of the show, it's sort of like, well, I don't know. I guess we'll finish the show. I don't know.
Well, let's get to that issue in a second about whether you can do something about it. You're suggesting for the most part you can't. But are we close to the point where facial recognition technology will be able to relatively accurately predict lifespan?
I think it's one indicator. I don't think it's the indicator. So damage to the skin, skin aging, looking at the cells there, they're part of the biological clock. So, yeah, there definitely is information there that's predictive. I'll bet it's more going to give you ranges like, you're getting to 5 years where your cells have gone through all their divisions. You don't have much more than 5 years to go. On the other hand, it's pretty predictive to just look at the calendar. I mean, insurance companies do that all the time, right? They're sort of like, oh, look at this guy's age, and here's his behavior, and, you know, he's pretty likely to be dead by X. It's not like it's the first time anybody's figured out indicators for that. But I'm going to come back and say it again. When you start talking to people really about this and say, how'd you like to know your death date? Most people are going to say, I want to know that.
Yeah, the only thing, they're in the same Washington Post article where Marjorie and I read about this thing, I'm going to read you a line. Longevity scientists say the key to extending healthy life lies in focusing on aging itself rather than aging-related diseases. And the implication from that is that there is something you can do about aging. You seem to disagree.
Well, I don't think there's anything you can do about it yet. But I do agree, this is controversial, I think aging itself is a disease. I don't mean just getting more likely to get cancer as you get older. I mean wear and tear and genes get mutations and things start to fall apart. We don't know how to fix that. We don't know what to do about that part of it. We could try to do research to extend our lives, and I wouldn't oppose that. But for some people, interestingly enough, they think that would be wrong because they think aging is natural and you shouldn't interfere with the process. That is to say, you know, if you think aging happens because God cursed us or because it's just the old getting out of the way of, so the new can flourish, not everybody believes we should launch a project to fix aging. I do, because I think aging, you know, is just another set of biological errors and mistakes as we fall apart. But others don't see it that way.
Yeah, well, tragically for all of us, by the time they figured out our expiration date, we'll be here.
Speak for yourself, Mark.
And we'll be gone. I agree with that.
Art Kaplan, let me ask you one last thing here. We talked about this earlier this week. There was this incredible story that said that people prefer electric shocks and would even shock themselves rather than be alone with their thoughts, no cell phones, no TV, no radio, no nothing, for 10 minutes. Now, what do you make of that?
Wasn't that men more than women?
It was men more than women, yeah, but women weren't crazy about it either.
So, first of all, let me say that there's only one fate worse than that, which is listening to me. You'll want to shock yourself completely into an utter coma that way. But I think it shows us that we live in an age where we have been conditioned and have learned, I don't think this is biology, I think it's culture, that we want stimulation all the time. Computer,
right.
TV, internet, blah, blah, blah. We expect things to happen. Younger people, my students, when they see something that takes more than a Twitter length message to read or a couple of seconds to flash up on the screen, they're moving on. So I think we're sort of shifting our, if you will, our ability to be contemplative, our ability to kind of reflect. It's just not part of the culture. That's what I think is happening.
Well, on that upbeat note, there's nothing we can do about aging. We have no attention span. Despite all that, by the way, congratulations. You won the Public Service Award from, what is it, the National Science Board? Is that the name of the operation?
That's true.
Congratulations.
And, no one remembers because it happened last week, but yes.
That's great.
Our memories are gone, and I can't contemplate what it was true.
Much deserved. Congratulations, Art Kaplan.
All right, thank you for being with us, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the book Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. And up next, we look at the intersection of race, class, and identity in higher education. It's the subject of a new anthology. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at WGBHnews.org, welcome to the battle to get kids running, jumping, and playing outside instead of on a touchscreen. If you missed it on the radio, catch it online at WGBHnews.org right now.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, whether your tastes run toward Dawn of the Planet of the Apes or the shot heard round the world, Arts Editor Jared Bowen has something for you. Tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
Support for our programs comes from you and Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close to you. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. And the X1 DVR from Xfinity, a multi-room DVR. You can download your DVR recordings right to your mobile device and watch them on the go. It's all part of the X1 Entertainment Operating System. More at 1-800-XFINITY.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Last year, a survey conducted by the National Hispanic Media Coalition found that at least 30% of non-Hispanic Americans mistakenly believe that half of the nation's 50 million Hispanics were illegal immigrants with large families and little education. Our guest says these kinds of negative stereotypes can exacerbate what is already an intimidating environment, the college campus. Jennifer DeLeon is the editor of a new anthology. It's called Wise Latinas, Writers on Higher Education. She's an author, an educator in the Boston Public Schools, and an instructor at Grub Street Creative Writing Center. But Jennifer, pleasure to meet you.
You too, as well.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for coming in. So you took your title, Wise Latinas, from Sonia Sotomayor, Supreme Court Justice. Quote, you have that at the tip of your tongue. If not, I got it right here.
Yes, she says, well, I would hope a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experiences would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life.
And that caused her a lot of problems in her confirmation hearing, we should say.
Yeah. Rush Limbaugh went crazy
over
the whole thing. But so why did you, I mean, I assume she's a huge inspiration because she's talked a lot about growing up as a Latina. So that's why it became the title of your book?
Yes, exactly. She's an inspiration to me, but also I think to many women. She's an anomaly on the Supreme Court. She's one of four justices that have not been white males in the entire history of the Supreme Court. So she faces many barriers, and her experience can really be inspirational to everyone, actually.
Well, she's also talked about something that's so right on target with what your whole book of these essays about, of women in higher education. Well, she talked about when she went to Princeton, and she called it, this would have been in the early 1970s, she felt like she was, quote, a visitor landing in an alien country. And this is what a lot of the women talk about in your book.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I'll tell you, when I first went to Connecticut College, even before I enrolled, when I was looking at schools, I felt that I was visiting a country club. And I really do feel that way. It was across the ocean, across the Coast Guard. You could eat whatever you want. You could stay up until whatever time you wanted. Nobody told you what to do. My father wasn't there. And I just felt free in a way that I hadn't felt until then.
And it also does look like a country club. I took one of my kids there. That is one gorgeous campus with a gym overlooking the river or ocean or whatever it is down there.
The ocean.
Yeah, very nice.
Jennifer DeLeon, let's step back just to give people a sense of the world that we're talking about. You mentioned in the foreword to your book, which is beautifully written.
Thank you.
I should say, great stories about you and your mother, which I love, which we'll talk about
in
a minute.
We're in tears here.
You said only 28% of college-age Latinos are enrolled in universities. And I read that is compared to 45% of whites, 64% of Asians, 34% of Blacks. And the numbers were frighteningly low. And then I read this Pew Center thing, which I couldn't sort of fit together. A record 7 in 10, 69% Hispanic high school graduates in the class of 2012 enrolled in college, 2 percentage points higher than the rate for their white counterparts. And then I realized, I assume, we're, the way those things work is the rate of high school graduates who are Latinos go to college is high, but the percentage of college-age Latinos who are high school graduates is very low. That's where the disconnect is, right?
Right, right. There's also a disconnect when you consider matriculation versus graduation. there are students who have the courage and, of course, the background to be able to apply to competitive schools, and they enroll, but they drop out after the first semester. They think, this isn't for me. This is a foreign country. This is strange. I'm in a different universe. And so, unfortunately, while the numbers show that more Latinos, gratefully, are enrolling in college, it's not the same as them matriculating. And then the numbers just get worse when it goes to graduate school and PhD level.
Is this, I am generally not a cup half full kind of guy, but I'm a cup almost totally empty kind of guy. But when you read these statistics, I think you may have even mentioned this. I'm not sure if it was you or somebody else I was reading this morning. 30% of America is going to be Latino by the middle of this century.
Exactly.
So since the numbers are exploding like this, would I be naive to think things are getting better, or they're not? I mean, Deval Patrick spends an hour here every month. I would say once out of every two appearances, he talks about the achievement gap between kids of color and white kids in the schools. They're making some progress, but are we making a lot of progress or no?
I would say we're moving in the right direction, but I will say that there are factors we're not looking at. Test scores are one way that we can look at it. And as a Boston public school teacher, I teach at the Boston Teachers Union School, which I love. You know, we're definitely working to help students have those tools in their toolbox. I mean, they have to be able to perform well on standardized tests. They have to be able to write an essay really well. That said, there's an element of cultural capital that is equally important, so that when you have internships here at WGBH, you know, you feel confident and competent. You're not thinking, oh, everybody's looking at me strangely, or what are you bringing for lunch, or what is it that you're reading? You're different. I don't look like any of you. So there is that element. I know when I did internships at the State House, I felt, again, like an anomaly. And then over time, you build that confidence. So then when I do my next internship at Ms. Magazine in New York City, I think, okay, I belong here. I feel a little bit more comfortable. And then an internship at the United Nations, I think, okay, I can do this. So there's a snowball effect. It builds. But I think we have to give kids the opportunities to build that. You can't just say, go to college, you're going to be great.
Now, I hope they paid you in your internship at Ms. Magazine.
They paid me with experience. And
I'm disappointed in Gloria Steinem. I thought she would pay people for it, because you mentioned that you met her when you were there.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I did publish a couple of articles, and those did pay.
Good.
I remember I was so excited, a dollar a word. I was rich.
But can we stay on this whole issue of this comfort zone thing you mentioned a minute ago? Is the comfort zone built internally, or are the institutions you're describing conscious about providing a more welcoming environment? Since your book is about higher ed, Latinos in the higher ed, universities obviously want their numbers to look good. They want to look like they're diverse, hopefully for good reasons, but at minimum for bad reasons, doesn't matter for purposes of this. Do they then work to create an environment where someone who does feel like, whatever it is Sotomayor said, a visitor landing in an alien country, that they feel like they're a visitor, but it's not an alien country? Or is it all on the human themselves to create their, you know what I mean?
Right,
create their
right.
comfort zone? What's the deal?
I mean, I think it's a combination. Imagine you go to a university starting tomorrow, and everybody's told you, you can handle it, you're great, you're going to be amazing, your scores allowed you to get in, full scholarship, great. You go, and every last person is a female. You know, you might be, again, told, you're fine, you can handle it, sit in the same class, hang out with these people, but they're all female. So as much as you're given those positive messages, the reality is going to take some muscle work. I mean, ultimately, seeing yourself represented by the professors at the campus matter, not just people cleaning the restrooms and all of that. Seeing yourself represented in the literature that you read, so that if all of the articles are published by white men, you might think, well, I don't really have a place in academia, so why pursue a PhD? No one's going to take me seriously.
Well, you know what I was thinking, too, that, you know, obviously there's some similarities between the African-American experience when African-Americans first went to college, and but most of those African-Americans were African-Americans. Latinas are all over the map. You could be from Guatemala, as your family was, or from, you know, any other. There's so many different cultural things. That's an issue, I would think, as well. You're not a monolithic group.
Right. And, in fact, that's another barrier that I think many Latinas face when they go to college, Latinos as well. People put them in a box. They assume they speak Spanish. They assume they're first-generation college students. They assume XYZ. So there's a lot of debunking these myths when you get to school. And I think that, you know, again, the more Latinos we have in school, the more it becomes normal. But the book I really want to my goal for this book is to provide stories, you know, narrative, because these statistics I think are so valuable and they ultimately do create change and provide funding for organizations that can help facilitate that. But there's nothing like the story. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Well, tell us about the young woman that went to Vanderbilt.
Oh, yeah. Toni Plummer. Yes. So she Blanca Torres. Apologies. Yes.
Okay.
She went to Vanderbilt. Her parents worked at a potato peeling plant in the Northwest. They were from Mexico. She always knew that she would pursue education. They would drive by the local community college and her parents would say to her, that's where you go after high school. So they had it in their mind. And again, that's a stereotype that Latino parents don't want their kids to go to college. Of course, that's not true for all of them, although leaving home is kind of a big deal. And so she, on a whim, applied to Vanderbilt. She gets in and she goes. It was not a school that she had dreamt about her whole life. She didn't know too much about it. But then when she gets there, she starts to doubt herself. She saw all these Vandy girls with, you know, long hair and these outfits and high heels. And she thought, I can't compete with them. What do I have going on here? So, again, there are a number of times where you can turn around and pivot. But hopefully, you know, these stories will help.
So when did you get out of Connecticut College?
I graduated in 2001.
2001, so not that long ago. So did you have a group of other Latina women when you were there?
So
big group, tiny group?
Small group, not at Connecticut College. There are friends of mine that I went to high school with, and every time I came home from on break, we'd go to Starbucks and we'd hang out for 6 hours. Just talk, and share these stories and our cuentos and just kind of, I don't know, exhale. At Connecticut College, I had a couple of mentors who were older, senior sisters. But again, there's this kind of pressure I felt, too, actually, on the flip side, when I went to Connecticut College to only interact with students of color. And that had never been my experience. I grew up in Framingham, and I just felt really comfortable with all sorts of people from different backgrounds. So there's some backlash for that, too.
You know, part of we're talking to Jennifer DeLeon, whose book called Wise Latinas, Writers Are in Higher Education, it's edited. There's a terrific forward introduction by her, which we're talking in part about. You know, we've talked about how the institutions cannot be welcoming and how society at large can have all these stereotypical, horrible thoughts about Latinos. But there's also a cultural barrier in many things. Another thing you write about, you talk about this essay, Only Daughter, written by Sandra Cisneros, who writes, after 4 years in college and 2 more in graduate school and still no husband, my father shakes his head even now and says, I wasted all that education. So it's not just the outside world, it's the inner world that one has to contend. You said in your thing, education was like a religion in your household, but obviously it was not a religion in Sandra Cisneros' household.
Exactly. You know, you're hitting on a great point, which is this irony that parents want the best for their kids until they have to leave. Uh-huh. You know, and I think with the Cuban-American experience, it's very fascinating because so much of their history has been centered on staying together. And, you know, the separation has been very political, literally and figuratively. And so the fact that they would be in Florida, in Miami, and want to go to school at Mount Holyoke, say, like one of the contributors writes, it's unheard of. And she kept that glossy catalog of Mount Holyoke for years until she got married, because she never went to the Northeast for college. And it was something that she gave up to be closer to home. And I think she went to Arkansas, 10 hours away, and it was still considered going far.
So one of the things that Sonia Sotomayor complained about at Princeton, this again was the 70s, so it was a long time ago, not a single full-time Latino professor in a class on Latin America. I would presume that that was different by the time you got to Connecticut College, or maybe not.
Right.
Were there any full-time Latino professors at Connecticut College when you were there?
There was one. I know she was visiting professor, and it was a women's studies course that I took. It was actually a course on whiteness, and so that's kind of the...
I've taught that course many times in my career, actually.
Yeah, Professor Carillo Roe, I remember.
And that was it, so there was one.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
And she was visiting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, by the way, when you say it was a long time ago, 1970... What was Barack Obama protesting about, leading demonstrations at Harvard Law School not so long ago?
No blacks.
No black full tenure until the Derek Bell situation.
So you teach kids K through 8, right?
Yes.
The school you're at. So I want, because in the Boston public schools now are largely black and Latina, largely minority. So I wonder if you see in these little boys and little girls that you interact with all the time, difference of being more self-assured, more confident, or is it just because they're in that environment and it's the same thing when they get to college 5 or 10 years down the road?
I've taught every grade level, elementary, middle school, high school. I did a Teach for America program in San Jose, California.
Oh, neat.
I taught at UMass Boston, adjuncting, and it's a really rich question and not something I can kind of boil down. But I would say that my general impression is that we still have a lot of work to do with the confidence level. There are students who have been born in this country and have gone only to English-speaking schools and, you know, are being raised in our culture here, but still lack that kind of agency that I see in students that I went to Connecticut College with. That said, they're brilliant and they're smart and they're sassy and they're unstoppable. But they really need to be given the opportunities and the tools to exercise those muscles. You know, being exposed to internships, to field trips, just being around environments they're not maybe always familiar with, or seeing the ones that they're involved with as an asset. You know, speaking two languages is a great thing. The fact that my dad can, you know, build a shed in our backyard, that's a really cool thing. It's not that, oh, he's a blue-collar worker. You know, so the language we give to these kinds of labels is really powerful.
But when a kid of a certain age starts watching the news, or even if they don't watch the news, the television or the radio is on in their house, and they hear the news sort of by osmosis kind of thing, and the lead story almost every day is about a war over immigration in this country, and some of the most grotesque language being used about people who come across the border and what should happen to them. And does that not trickle down and have as negative effect as all the positive things you're talking about? I mean, it's a pretty tough environment to grow up in as a kid.
It is. And I think they know about immigration in a different way. They're not reading the headlines per se. They're not analyzing the news, but they have an uncle who just showed up in their living room one day and he's staying with them for 3 months before he moves on to the job that he's searching for. You know, so they're interacting with immigration on that level. In my class with my eighth graders, we watch movies like El Norte, which is an old film about a Guatemalan brother and sister who move from Guatemala to Los Angeles, and they have to crawl through this tunnel with rats. And it's a really sad story, a really compelling movie. And then we read The Circuit by Francisco Jimenez, which is about a migrant farm worker in California. And then this documentary that now I'm blanking on the name. But it's an amazing documentary that follows two 14-year-old kids from Honduras, which, as you know, right now is all in the
terrible
news. Terrible.
Yes.
What's happening to the migrant and has been happening. You know, it's certainly not new. But we follow these two kids, and they – Which Way Home is the name of the documentary. And they are aboard these trains, and they're making their way through Mexico into the United States. And for my students – it's the first time that they're actually seeing this in a way that feels real to them because the students are so young. I mean, the boys.
Yeah.
So they're saying, oh, this isn't just my 35-year-old uncle. This is a kid who's 13. I could be on top of a train right now. So we talk a lot about that. But in response to your question, I mean, do they see themselves? Is their confidence kind of wrinkled by seeing all these news headlines? I hope not. I think the average teenager is also a little narcissistic, so they're not very much looking at it that way, is my take anyway.
Well, congratulations on this fantastic book which
great,
I
Jennifer.
Learned a lot from. Jennifer DeLon, the name of the book, the name of the book is Wise Latinas, Writers on Higher Education. Jennifer is an educator in the public schools in Boston and an instructor at the Grub Street Cafe. Grub Street Creative Writing Center, goof that up. Anyway, thank you so much for being
with
us.
Jennifer.
And you can catch your Friday at the Harvard Bookstore in collaboration with the Grub Street Launch Lab at 7 o'clock for a panel discussion. To learn more, go to harvard.com. Thanks again for being with us. Up next, we're going to be joined by Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe. He joins us on his recent trip to Northern Ireland, where he's been looking at how the Boston College Oral History Project has backfired. Stay tuned for that conversation next on 89.7.
In 1957, the reach of segregation extended all the way to the world of literature.
Censorship for us begins with the color line.
The fight to publish by Langston Hughes and how it paved the way for future black writers. Poet Nikki Giovanni is with us. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding everyone that adults play an important role in encouraging children to read. Reading is the key to success, so read to your children every day and encourage them to love books.
And Old Sturbridge Village, children 17 and under receive free daytime admission to this 1830s New England Living History Museum during July and August. Restrictions apply. More details at osv.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's a complicated geopolitical whodunit. It could have been plucked straight out of John le Carré's imagination. A political leader celebrated for brokering peace among political foes gets arrested for a murder that happened over 40 years ago. And the arrest is based on information that was supposed to remain under lock and key. That's the real-life story of Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. But this is just the beginning of a story that is still unfolding and reverberating from the Boston College campus all the way to Belfast. Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen picks up where we and most other media have left off. He's been in Belfast reporting on how the Boston College Oral History Project betrayed a promise of secrecy and in turn has threatened a very vulnerable process. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see both of you.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. Kevin, as Jim just said, the information here was all supposed to be kept under lock and key. Mm-hmm. It didn't quite turn out that way. So tell people that haven't followed this story what the Belfast Project is, what the idea was.
Well, I mean, it happened, Marjorie, in sort of the heady days after the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 effectively ended what the Irish and their penchant for understatement called the Troubles, the war in Northern Ireland. And I think BC was very influential in the peace process. They went out of their way to host people from Northern Ireland, both civil society, but also paramilitaries. I remember when the Protestant paramilitaries called off their armed struggle in 1994, the very first place six of them came to talk about it in America was Boston College. So Boston College has always been invested in the peace process and very much involved in Ireland. So somebody at BC had the bright idea, hey, why won't we start an oral history project? And what we'll do is take the oral histories of people that fought the war, the combatants, both on the Republican side, the Irish would have been the Irish Republican Army, and on the Loyalist side, in this case, the Ulster Volunteer Force. So in that respect, it was a sort of a noble and inspired idea. And I can tell you that knowing people at BC and listening to what them explain themselves, they never believed for a minute that what they compiled would then be sought by people in law enforcement. Now, I personally think that's extremely naive. Knowing the political nature of policing in Northern Ireland was always what the issue was. I mean, when the war, as we would call it, really broke out in the late 60s, it was because civil rights demonstrators on the Catholic National side were literally beaten off the streets by police. If the police had done their job, it never would have happened. So policing is still political. It's very political. And the idea that, you know, when Ed Maloney, who BC hired to direct the project, wrote a book and more or less told the world, hey, by the way, we have all these interviews with these guys. And in this case, Brendan Hughes, who is now dead, said that Gerry Adams ordered the abduction, murder, and secret burial of a woman named Jean McConville, a widowed mother of 10. That was see you later. Then the cops, it was only a matter of time before the cops went after, as far as I'm concerned.
Before we get back to the naivete of BC and what they should do, Kevin Kellen, what representations did BC make to the participants in this project about the confidentiality, about the secrecy of the documents, the interviews, all that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, if you look at the actual agreements, I think, you know, BC, you know, did not promise more than it could deliver in some respects. The problem is they got lost in translation over the Atlantic Ocean. Everybody who spoke to them, and I just was in Belfast and interviewed a number of people who gave oral histories, they were absolutely guaranteed. They were absolutely, in their minds, nothing would ever pry this out of the hands of BC until they were dead. And then if you look at the papers, and Boston College has shown them. I mean, Jack Dunn has waved it for everyone to see.
Spokesperson for BC.
He said that, you know, look here. It says that BC will protect it as far as American law will allow. But this is also where we really get into muddy ground here, Jim, because the police And then the British authorities contacted the Justice Department, citing a treaty that the UK and the US signed, saying that if we have information for them in criminal matters, we will turn it over to them and vice versa. It's a two-way street. But there is a political exception in there. It makes clear this treaty says that if there are political offenses or there could be political ramifications, then the either government can opt out. And clearly this was politically. There was politics all over this. When the leader of the largest nationalist party in Ireland is the target of a criminal investigation – that is political by any definition. So you know, I don't think the thing should have been turned over.
So the reason this all is in the news right now, and I assume part of the reason you went over to Belfast to do this great story you did about the repercussions in Belfast, is because in May, the leader of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, was arrested. Mm-hmm. Now, what was that about?
Well, he was arrested. And in the UK and in Ireland, in those jurisdictions, arrest is not what we think of. When you're arrested in America, you are charged. It's one and the same. In Ireland and the UK, when you are arrested, you're arrested for questioning. And he was held for 4 days of detention. He says he was interviewed 33 separate times and that over a period of 96 hours and that they kept coming back. Everything they talked to him about was based on things that was told to BC researchers. So Gerry Adams came out of there and very publicly rubbished the Boston College Project, said that Ed Maloney and Anthony McIntyre were biased, that the history they compiled was biased because they were opposed to Adams and the way he handled it. And Adams has some legitimate points, frankly, on that thing. But the other thing, I really did pick this up when I was in Belfast talking to all these old IRA veterans. They were saying, hey, wait a minute. When people say this is not a legitimate history, it is. It's our history. And we are not in with the Sinn Féin leadership. No one will tell our story. So it is important that we put down what we say we experienced and what we thought of the whole conflict. And frankly, most of these guys, which I think is the other interesting thing, they're not saying, oh, we gave up too easy and we compromised. These guys are saying the war was not worth it for what we settled for. If you're an Irish Republican, you can't call yourself an Irish Republican and recognize the partition of your country. It's just mutually exclusive. And so they have legitimate points of views too. The thing that I did, and the whole idea of Mark Morrow's idea, the editor, not my idea to go over there, just said, see what the feel is on the ground. And what I sense is people are, in some respects, very afraid.
What's a tout?
A tout is, it's just the local idiom for informer. And it is a very loaded term in that culture. And that's what happened. I think you've probably seen the photographs of it.
Yes.
That right after Gerry Adams was arrested, people started spray, you know, painting on the gable walls, either the whitewash or black on a white wall. And it said, Boston College touts. Now, that's a very loaded term. And that's, believe me, it's directed at Anthony McIntyre. It's directed at a guy like Tommy Gorman, an IRA veteran who was publicly identified as giving an interview. It's directed at Ricky O'Rourke. It's directed at a number of guys that gave interviews. And, you know, they, as they told me, they are afraid because when you get called a tout in Ireland, you very often end up dead.
You know, speaking of Anthony McIntyre, we were discussing this whole project with a former board member, actually, of, I don't know if he's still on the board, Tommy O'Neill, a couple of months ago on mm-hmm. the radio. And Anthony McIntyre and his wife, Carrie Toomey, actually called us from Northern Ireland. He just did say to us that he feared for his life. Here's what else he said. This is Anthony McIntyre describing how BC, in his opinion, failed to protect the archives from the British authorities.
What the Boston College staff needed to do was to protect an endangered archive by getting it out of its custody immediately and sending it over to my custody, whereby I would ensure its protection. So Boston College left an endangered archive on its campus, vulnerable to a second subpoena, and so did not do what it could have done.
You know, speaking of what Anthony McIntyre just said, Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe, sending it over to my custody, they didn't do it when McIntyre would have liked it to have been done. Mm-hmm. They did it after the cat was out of the bag.
Yeah.
You open your piece this week with this beautiful story of this guy who gets a FedEx package. Tell that story for
That's
us, please,
Ricky,
and what he does with it.
Ricky O'Rourke. Ricky was actually one of the blanket men, the IRA, when they were demanding political status, they refused to wear prison uniforms. They wrapped themselves mm-hmm. in a blanket. Ricky was also the spokesman for the hunger strikers in 1981 and was very close to Bobby Sands, the first hunger striker who died. Ricky got his stuff back when BC said, we'll give it back if you want it. He goes, send it back. So it went to his lawyer's office. He picked up. He didn't quite know what to do with it. And then he said, am I going to hold it? Am I going to give it to my kids? And then when the police announced under, I think, political pressure, they wanted everything, not just stuff related to Gene McConville. But they wanted everything in the file, the whole archive. That's when Ricky said he opened a bottle of fine Bordeaux. He put this. He goes, I lit a nice fire. And he goes, it was a nice Bordeaux and it was a nice fire.
So, and he burnt
but I said to him, funny thing, I didn't put this in the story, but I said, you know, before I said, because he told me the story, I said, you know, Ricky, if I put that in the paper, you could be found in contempt of court. He goes, I am in contempt of that court.
is Ricky, who had his nice fire, is he assured that this is the only copy of these tapes? That's what I was thinking to myself.
That's a good question, Margie.
You know, he burned them and hoping they're done, but...
That's a good question. I mean, he was mad, too, because his stuff, he said he knew nothing about the McConville case because he was in Ballymurphy, and that was done by the Lower Falls. That would be Company D in the Lower Falls for the IRA. So he didn't know anything about it. So he didn't know why his stuff was turned over to the court in the first place. So Judge Young has seen Ricky's stuff.
We're talking with Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen has written this fantastic piece about the reaction in Belfast to this whole the arrest of Jerry Adams back in May and the allegations that he was involved in the murder of Gene McConville. Kevin, tell people about Gene McConville. You didn't get into this in your story, but this is a really horrifying story of what happened to her.
One of the most horrific. I mean, there were more than 3,500 people killed in what we call the Troubles, and hers is one of the most disturbing. It was 1972. 1972 was actually the bloodiest year of the Troubles. Like more than 500 people were killed. And we're talking about a place roughly the size of Connecticut with about 1.5 million people. And she was accused of being an informer. Now, that it's very, very murky. Now, she was married to a Protestant. I mean, she was a Protestant. She married a Catholic guy. And so she was suspect in that. She would have been seen as a prod or one of them. And there was all suspicious. So anyway, she was abducted. She was dragged from her in front of her kids.
They were and the little, husband was dead already.
Yeah, he had died the year before.
So she was the only support of
That's
these
it.
10
he,
children.
And I mean, they described, I mean, I talked to one of her sons who described that, you know, they were literally holding onto her leg as the IRA guys were dragging her out of the house. And those kids were scattered like so many, you know, orphans all over the place and had very tough lives after that. Now, obviously, what was unusual about the Gene McConville case is that Jim asked about touts. In touts were, informers were very, very, you know, publicly humiliated and executed and left in the side of the road for people to see. But I think somebody in the IRA decided, you know, killing a widowed mother of 10 might look a little bad. So what they decided to do was they shot her. And then they buried her on a beach in County Louth on the Irish Republic side of the border, because I guess somebody in the IRA decided this would just look too bad if we are blamed for this murder. And so the IRA actively promoted the myth that she had just run off to England with somebody, that she couldn't take the stress of having 10 kids and no husband. And they did not find her body until 2003. And it's always, like I said, it's always been one of the most horrific deaths of the Troubles. That said, the police did absolutely nothing to solve that murder. They never interviewed anybody. They never opened a file. They never did anything. It's only when the Boston College tapes became aware, somebody in the police said, hey, we can go after Adams. You know, if somebody is saying, I've always questioned, what's the evidentiary of this stuff was not given with warning. It was not taken under oath. It's just people telling stories. And there's no way to verify most of this information. It's just he says, she says. And so, you know, Adam says the people that have publicly been identified as saying he was involved in the murder of Gene McConville, one being Brendan Hughes, the Dark, who was a very famous IRA guy and very close to Jerry Adams, actually, during their time in the IRA. And then Dolores Price, who has also died, she claims that she actually went to drive Gene McConville to her interrogators who killed her. So, you know, Adam says these are just political enemies, people that fell out with him, and they figured the best way they could get back at him is to try to pin a murder on him. So that's where he says.
We're talking to Kevin Cullen, who has written a wonderful piece in the Globe about what he's calling the new Troubles. You know, staying on the Adams thing
before,
for a minute.
Before we leave that story, I just want to tell one quick story, because I happened to be over in Dublin when Adams was arrested, and you saw the children interviewed constantly on television, Gene McConville's surviving children. And one of the things they talked about, which shows the level of terror terror that they, some of their neighbors, they claim anyway, that they, where they lived, were involved in abducting their mother. But because they were so afraid for their own lives, some of the people were hooded in masks and some of them weren't, they never told who those neighbors were because they were afraid that they'd be killed if they did.
Yeah, I've heard Michael McGonigal say that.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin, for those of us naive enough to think that this was over, a couple of things come to mind. One, I think you wrote, and if you, I think it was you who wrote, at the time of the Adams arrest, whatever an arrest means, you described a couple of minutes ago, there were questions. If it turns out they legitimately, the police there legitimately thought this is worth investigating 40 years after the fact, why was it only one side's leaders who was, is that, I assume that is the talk. Is why Adams and why not people on the other side of this conflict?
Exactly. And well, like I said, I think that's why the police launched this, we want the whole thing, because they were being criticized as being very selective in their prosecution.
But that hasn't changed in the...
No, it hasn't, in the sense that the idea, and I put in my story, that it's, you know, while the police want these BC records, they are refusing to turn over their own records to the police ombudsman in Northern Ireland, who was trying to investigate at least 60 cases of police and military collusion in the murder of it would be mostly Catholic nationals. One, what's really intriguing, one of those 60 murders the ombudsman wants is of an RUC man, a police officer, and there's allegations that his own people set him up to be killed by the IRA. It's very explosive stuff, but the cops won't turn that stuff over. The other thing, Jim, about this whole thing, it just shows that we are in a post-conflict society that they don't know what truth and reconciliation, they don't know how to get there. They don't know how to find truth. And that's why the sad part is I think the BC thing was a very idealistic idea to get this out there. And then 30 or 40 years, historians would see this stuff. Unfortunately, people found out about it and it became this political football that will not go away.
Well, let me continue my naivete. Is it beyond the lives of the individuals who feel threatened as touts or whatever it is, you write, some worry the personal disputes and fear of potential prosecutions that the BC interviews have given rise to could do serious damage to Northern Ireland's hard-won, much-admired, but still evolving and ever-fragile peace process. So the trickle-down or trickle-up or trickle-sideways implications of this disclosure are huge, well beyond the lives of the individuals.
And the dissident groups there are basically riddled with informers themselves. The police do a fairly good job on them. But, you know, what they've been trying to do in recruiting kids who know nothing about this stuff, to get 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids who are just angry and they don't like growing up. They've been recruiting them on the grounds that, hey, nothing has changed. The Brits are still lying to us. And if they charge, say Adams is charged with this crime and is brought to trial, I can guarantee you there's going to be real political fallout. There's going to be problems. There are going to be more people going to the dissident groups because they'll be able to say, see, nothing has changed. And it also allows the dissidents to go back at Sinn Féin and say, you guys bought you bought this hook, line, and sinker from the Brits. Nothing has changed. They go after us. They don't go after their own people that do things wrong. So there's an awful lot at stake here. Now, there is another case involved, Ivor Bell, who was an IRA commander, who actually had a big falling out with Gerry Adams in the mid-'80s and was more or less drummed out of the IRA. He has been arrested and is still facing trial for his involvement. The allegation in court was he was charged based on evidence that was included in the BC archive. So this is serious stuff.
You know, as I'm only the only non-Irishman in the studio at the moment, and not a lifelong Bostonian like you guys. Well, you're a Fall River kid who became Bostonian. I have to say, I'm pretty proud of the role, as you described, that Boston played in this whole thing. But you end your story about saying how tarnished the reputation of Boston. You quote Anthony McIntyre, we were talking about, saying he was listening to the radio and the song More Than a Feeling by Boston. The group came up. He says, it used to be one of my favorite songs, but when it came on the other day, I was like, screw it, I hate it. I don't like anything that has Boston in it. What is the spillover in terms of Boston's reputation?
Well, I think, first of all, BC always had a very good reputation, particularly in the North, but also in the Republic of Ireland, as a player, as a force for good, as an honest broker, whatever you want to call it. And there's no doubt that that image has been tarnished. Everywhere I went in Ireland, people asked me the same question. Why did BC give up the records? Why didn't they fight?
What was your answer to that
My
question?
Answer is I don't know, because Jack Dunn and other people at BC have publicly stated they couldn't be in violation of a court order. But our great friend Harvey Silverglade has made it very clear that why couldn't Father Leahy or somebody at BC come out on the stairs and say, you will get these things over my dead body, and if you want to put me in jail, put me in jail.
Speaking of that, by the way, let me read Harvey's quote, which I think was quite great, a month or two ago. He says, he talks about it is better than if an academic institution is going to get involved in this, it's better that an academic institution not agree to exert control over them and not going to protect them. Then his line, his takeaway is, that should be left to individuals willing to risk the consequences of adhering to conscience, which is pretty heavy.
It's like a reporter in a way with a source, right?
Marjorie, you and I both know that manna from heaven, imagine if we get thrown in the can.
No,
we'd be on the
No, seriously, first of all.
You know, it's not that bad down at Nashua Street anymore.
Oh, geez.
But no, say
speak
I got thrown in the can, I'd be a hero. I'd be celebrated. I'd probably get a bonus. Well, no, I probably wouldn't get a bonus. But then again, no, seriously, people would say, and there's no doubt I would go to the can. I mean, I've been brought in, you know, it's never got to the push to shove, but I've had cops coming after my notes before on murders and
so
stuff.
So speculate about why?
I don't know. Like I said, I think it's cultural. Like Harvey says, I think people in academia aren't willing to go that extra mile, whereas I think journalists not only are willing to do it, they would welcome it because it would be, you would stand up for your principles and say, I am not a gatherer of information for a law enforcement agency.
Well, how about then, Carmen Ortiz, you mentioned this political exemption a couple of minutes ago to this treaty. So the police there contact the United States government, say we want this information. Based on your interpretation of this treaty, Kevin
Justice
Cullen
could have said no.
Ortiz could have said we're not either. What's his name?
Holder. It was Holder's
call.
It was Holder's call.
Or then in turn, Ortiz could say, "I'm not. We're not issuing these subpoenas."
Do that? I can only speculate that after 10 years of standing with us in Iraq and Afghanistan, we basically somebody in Washington say we owe the Brits this. I do not think they looked at this very closely, as you know. Other people have written, and I've suggested in some columns. We're actually undermining American diplomacy by doing this. The Americans spent billions of dollars in untold political capital. We said, poor George Mitchell had to live there, for God's sakes, for about 5 years and get this thing done. And frankly, it's been something that it started with the Clinton administration, but Bush did a good job with it, too. They've stayed right with it. Richard Haass, who was Bush's person, is still deeply involved in this, trying to help them get past some of the legacy issues. And yet we, our own government, basically facilitates something like this that can undermine what we just spent a generation accomplishing. It makes no sense to me, and I can only speculate that it was we got it at the people who made the decision, made it on, they're our allies, they want it, we'll give it. And the one thing I think is also interesting, when John Kerry was Senator John Kerry, he thought this was a terrible idea. Going after the files. He was opposed to it. Publicly, I actually wrote a column quoting John saying, this is wrong. It undermines American diplomacy. Then John Kerry becomes Secretary of State. Nada.
Doesn't say anything.
He hasn't said anything about it.
Well, you've partially already answered my last question, but I'll ask you anyway. Because so many people in Ireland, as you well know, are worried about the peace being broken and there being, you know, a return to what there was, let's hope not, many years ago. But is there any sort of higher authority kind of trying to mediate things and intervene so that the peace...
Richard Haass and Megan O'Sullivan from Harvard.
Okay.
She's over there, too. They have been, for the last year, have been trying to help the people in Northern Ireland confront their legacy issues, which also involve triumphalist marching, which we're going to see in the next week.
Marching
the Orange Men. That's the Orange Order. It's a fraternal organization, Protestants. And they want to march through neighborhoods where they're not welcome, basically. And that's an issue. And nationalists say they have the rights to say no. Orange Men say they have the right to march to what they call the Queen's Highway. It's an issue that won't go away. And I can guarantee you that in what day is it? In a week, there'll be stories all over the place. You guys will have it on the NPR News of fights and all kinds of crap breaking out in Northern Ireland. It's an annual ritual of sort of tribalism that hasn't gone away. And I know Haass is very – I haven't talked to him personally, but I've talked to somebody just last week who works with him and said he's utterly frustrated that the Irish can't seem to get beyond these issues. And I have to remember that Northern Ireland is still incredibly segregated. 90% of people live in neighborhoods where everybody is just like them. I mean, sounds like America now that I come to think of it. But it's more segregated even than in America. And the peace process has done nothing to address that. When the Good Friday Agreement was signed, about 5% of kids in Northern Ireland went to integrated schools. That number has not moved one iota in 15 years.
Okay.
Kevin, great to see you. Terrific.
Not very optimistic there, Kevin. I hope things work out better. Kevin Collins is a columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book, along with Shelley Murphy, and this is a great book. You and Shelley did an awesome job, Kevin Collins. I loved it. Is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Thanks again for being with us, Kevin. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation with food writer Corby Kummer. We'll ask him if competitive eating should be considered legitimate sport. We also talked.
It's the only sport I can play, actually, Marge.
That's right. Go get those sausages, Jim. We also talked to the physician behind the new initiative to prescribe outdoor activity for kids. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, our engineer, John Parker, and our wonderful intern, Devin Karambulis. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow.